Good morning, everyone, to the NSPS Radio Hour. Here we are late in July, the 22nd. The year is going by way too quickly, as is life. Welcome, Eric and Michael.
Hey, nice to be here.
For the audience, my guests today are Eric Gackstatter and Michael Dennis. Both of those names are probably familiar to most of our audience, but in case they are not, we'll start with Michael. Michael, just tell everybody a little bit about what you're up to these days, and then we'll have Eric do that so everybody's aware.
Oh, thanks, Kurt. I'm Michael Dennis. I work for the National Geodetic Survey as a geodesist. I've been here, it'll be only 3 years in November, and I've worked in the private side for quite a few years prior to that on a surveying and geodetic consulting company in Arizona. So I have a lot of private sector experience, which I think actually helps a lot with my job here at NGS, though it does lead to some frustrations. I'm very much interested in a big part of what I do here is to helping people deal with their data. So that's what we're going to talk about in this show.
Yeah, that's very true, and we're glad to have you on the show. As Eric had mentioned before we came on the air, I had Dave Doyle on not too long ago, and, of course, everybody knows Dave's name, and we talked about similar topics, not exactly the same thing necessarily, but and David and I, during that show, Michael, talked about the situation with you guys there at NGS and with all the retirements coming along. You even mentioned that during the survey summit a couple of weeks ago. So I know that that's going to have some impact on the ability to service everybody, but I know you guys will get it done.
Yeah, it's a big challenge, but we're working towards it.
Yes, sir, for sure. And Eric, just remind everybody about your ventures.
Sure. I started in the GPS industry back in 1990. I was working for a small spinoff of HP back then, and then that's when GPS receiver boards first started to become available, and so we integrated those inside of our handhelds at the time and created an entire product line around GPS, and I coordinated software development and some of the hardware development for lots of different surveying and mapping products based on GPS. And then in 2000, I quit and formed my own consulting company and then ended up writing for GPS World and Geospatial Solutions on a monthly basis and hit a ton of conferences and try to stay in touch with guys like Michael who are true experts in this kind of technology.
Yeah, that latter thing has virtually taken you around the world, I guess, in attending conferences.
It really has. I mean, I've had the honor of being able to travel to Russia and Africa and Western Europe a few times, and even Taiwan back in my product development days.
And I know Dave talks about this a lot, as do all the other folks we know who travel the world. And you know, the issues are the same, maybe at different stages of development, but overall the issues are the same as we begin to be more in tune. I'm talking about in the surveying community, in tune with our connection to the world and in terms of positioning. And I talked about this with my guest last week, as a matter of fact, about how the fact that we've been so localized all of our existence almost. And so it's always interesting to talk about these issues. And I know that we're going to talk today about a number of things, but in particular about some things you've written recently, Eric. I would be remiss if I didn't say to our audience that, or remind our audience that we do have our Parker Davis Quick Stakes contest again this week, as we always do. And maybe we're going to take a novel approach this week. Our question is going to be to Eric and Michael when they became acquainted, and in our preliminary conversations, neither of them remembers exactly, so I guess we'll debate that for the answer today when we get into the question a little bit later in the show. And for you, Eric and Michael, the way it works is we ask the question sometime usually in the middle of or end of the second segment, and then people have the opportunity to send in an answer to quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com. Quickstakes is QuickStakes, and quickstakes contest is all one word. And the first person to answer the question correctly, or at least as we have deemed it to be correct, we'll get a gift certificate from Parker Davis. So we'll take care of that as we go a little bit further in the show. Before we get too deeply into it, though, Eric, I don't know if you saw an email message that I sent to you this morning. I just got it over the weekend from Carl Sederbach. I don't know if you guys know Carl. Carl's on our board. He's from Nevada. And he was referencing an article that just came out in National Review about a lot of different things, but basically uses of the spectrum, the open spectrum. And he was promoting the open skies, open spectrum philosophy. And he had made some statements about the light squared issue that we may need to take a look at. So you probably haven't seen that yet, but I forwarded that on so you would have it to take a look
at. Actually, I did see it. I took a look at it. I got your email about 15 minutes ago, and I took a quick peek, and to me, there's nothing new there. You know, basically what he's saying is that, hey, the upside, what the article is saying is that the upside for improved wireless broadband far outweighs the cost to the GPS user community and, I guess, operators and so on. And so he's basically saying, hey, you know, GPS folks, you guys deal with it, and we think our agenda is much more important than your system right now, and you can deal with the upgrades and so on. To a point, I don't disagree. And I've said this all along, it's really not about GPS folks saying, hey, we can't do this, we don't want to do this. I think it's really an issue of timing and cost, because if you take this attitude and say, hey, we want to be light squared, for example, we want to be operational in 3 or 6 months, I mean, that's a major, major problem, given all the GPS infrastructure out there. How in the world do you upgrade all this infrastructure when solutions for this interference aren't even readily available yet? There's been some proposed technical solutions to help overcome this sort of noisy neighbor effect, but there really isn't any solid technical solutions out there for this. And number two, the timing is a major issue, because the shorter the time frame, the higher the cost raises exponentially. So if we're talking about 20 years from now, maybe 15 years from now, this, you know, I'm okay with this. I mean, if because everybody's sort of going through their equipment upgrade cycles, infrastructure, especially big chorus networks, have a chance to upgrade their infrastructure, and it gives them time to do this. And so that's a reasonable conversation to have. What is not a reasonable conversation is for someone to say, hey, we want to roll out this wireless network, you know, next year, and GPS folks go deal with it. That's not a reasonable solution.
Does the discussion about the buffers, doing away with buffers, which is what the Open Skies Open Spectrum does, I suppose, does that exacerbate the problem in any way, or is it just another component of it?
Well, the buffer right now is, I mean, that's what we're using now to protect GPS in a way. I mean, it's such a weak signal that, you kind of, everybody tells me this analogy is wrong, but I like to use it because it's easy to understand. It's like if you have a rock band in the neighbor's backyard, I mean, in your yard, you're still going to hear it. You're going to hear it. You won't be able to hear your TV because it's so loud. And so to deal with that right now, there's a buffer in there. And everybody in this whole spectrum neighborhood is all using the quiet zone, I should say. So at what point how close do you let a noisy neighbor start to operate whatever they're going to do, the rock band stage or whatever? That's what the buffer is right now. And there's been some suggestions or some technical proposals that, hey, that could be overcome, that somehow we could design GNSS receivers to filter out that noise and still be able to operate efficiently. Now, I've seen some proposed solutions, but I'm not sure I've seen any practical proposed solutions, practical from maybe a cost standpoint or ergonomic standpoint. And I'm sure that problem can be solved. My guess is that problem can be solved in the future. But, you know, that's step number one, because you can't really talk about doing any kind of upgrades until you have a solution. And, again, number two is the timing. Is, you know, there's such a huge amount of infrastructure out there that how do you replace that infrastructure that's financially palatable so you don't go broke trying to do it and don't affect services when you're trying to do that?
Yeah, and I think, as you say, the big question for the GPS users is there are answers to the problems. Perhaps they're down the road. We don't really know what they are yet, and maybe you overcome the interference problem somehow. But then the final question is, at what cost, I guess, and nobody knows what that is.
And actually, this is Michael here. I guess this light square thing's just not going to go away, huh? I own a small business in Arizona, and we have, what, 8, I think, G-data quality GPS receivers. It would be a major problem for us being so small to acquire new receivers or do something to upgrade those, I would think, at least from what I've seen so far, like Eric said. And there's a lot of surveyors anyway that would be a real problem for them.
Yeah, I liken it to the example of Y2K, if you all remember that 13 years ago, and that, you know, people, you know, there's this huge kind of ramp up to Y2K, and people replaced huge amounts of computer equipment, and it became like a forced upgrade, and manufacturers really cashed in on that because they knew you didn't have a choice, and so it puts you in a really tough position. Whereas if you have time to upgrade, I mean, in Michael's case, you know, maybe you do, you know, a couple in 3 years and a couple more in 6 years and a couple more in that, you know, that's naturally the way business flows, and it's reasonable. You know, again, what wouldn't be reasonable is to tell someone like Michael, look, your equipment's not going to work in 6 months or a year. You've got to go out and replace all of them, and here's what it's going to cost you. And, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow for a small business.
Yeah, it certainly is. And we basically used up our first segment talking about that issue, but I wanted to bring it up because it was something that I hadn't seen until I got this from Carl over the weekend, and I think this article is fairly new as well. And obviously it's not new to the discussion per se, but it's another indication, as Michael said, that and you've said this, as have I, Eric, all along, this is not an issue you can just say, okay, it's over and done, because there's been way too much resources spent for it just to
go away.
It's not going to go away, that's for sure.
Right.
So the point here being that we have to keep our ear to the ground and be diligent and listen to the conversation as it evolves, and more importantly, be part of that conversation as it evolves, so that reasonable solutions are sought. So, according to my clock on my computer, which is about 6 minutes slow, I'm having to do math as we're doing this, so I know when to take a break. But I think we're right at the first break, so let's go ahead and do that. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Hi, Bob Eberson, back with some big news from Schoenstead. We've added a grand prize to our 60th anniversary Great Locator giveaway program, a Caribbean cruise for two, plus travel allowance and spending money. You're automatically entered for the year-end drawing when you enter to win a Schoenstead magnetic locator, which you can do every 60 days. Visit Schoenstead.com for complete details and your chance to win.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com. the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back on the NSPS Radio Hour with Michael Dennis and Eric Gaxeter. And I don't know, Eric or Michael, who wants to begin our discussion. I know we're going to talk a bit about some of the things you've written, Eric, so maybe that'd be a good place to start.
Well, let me do this first. I want to sort of dovetail into something you mentioned earlier about the international audience. And I apologize a couple different times lately to the readers of what I write. And so I've sort of focused on this whole ITRF to NAT83 transformation. But I don't know, Michael, I guess, you know, you get around a lot and talk to the international geodetic community more than I do. And can you sort of give us an idea what the scale of this problem is? Is it similar to what we're experiencing in the U.S. or is it not?
Well, Eric, I'm a little embarrassed to say I don't talk to the international geodetic community much about this and the relationships between, say, current geodetic data that's being used and, regional ones, say, like for Australia, and international ones. But based on what I know so far, that it's essentially the same situation all over the world, or worse. I mean, there's still a lot of places that are using even older datum, so you really have... The things we're talking about for the United States are all over the world, we'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we did. In my first series of the articles that I wrote, I did hear from folks in Australia and New Zealand mm-hmm. that they've got some similar issues over there. In fact, that sort of led to Michael and I were involved in this, I call it the Geodesy Crew, and we met up at the ESRI conference a couple of weeks ago. But sort of an informal group of people who have a common, I guess, interest in the discussion that's going to take place about datum transformations and that sort of thing. And so it is sort of an international crowd and all the way from oil and gas to academia and local surveying firms. So, yeah, I just more thinking about it. I don't have any idea of the scope, but I know there's just so many different datums out there. In my experience back in my product development days, it seems like every country you went to or even every region within a country has some sort of data and transformation they're doing, and I got to think they're having similar problems that we are here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's a certainty. And, the movement overall is towards truly geocentric datums. Like the United States, we're a little behind the curve on that probably. We're supposed to transition from NAT83 to a new datum in 2022, and that's mainly because we're waiting for gravity data for the vertical aspect of it. But, I mean, we could do it now. We're just waiting for that. And that's happening all over the world, I think. But even so, even if we do that, where we adopt a datum that's essentially identical to, let's say, ITRF, we still have this velocity issue, because even if we did that, we'd want to tie it to a certain date. And as soon as you do that, you start running into these issues with time.
Yeah, I think we ought to talk about that. That's sort of a good lead-off topic, is this whole epic date subject that, it's interesting because whenever I come across the geospatial data sets, I sort of look for that metadata, the date of collection and so on. And when people come to me with consulting projects and they're trying to combine different data sets from different sources, my first question to them always is, hey, what do you have for metadata? Because we need to know where this data came from and which data was collected, which epoch date it was referenced to. Because, the crustal movement or tectonic plate movement really comes into effect in certain parts of the world. And, if you think about Iowa, maybe only moving, a millimeter or a couple millimeters a year, the ground that is. But in some place like California, it moves 5 centimeters a year. And if you think about it, if you're using RTK and you're getting 1 to 2 centimeter accuracy, and land is moving 5 centimeters a year, and you want to return to that exact location 5 years from now, that's what, 5 times 5, that's 25 centimeters. That's almost a foot difference, right? And it's since GNSS equipment is becoming so much more affordable now, the accurate stuff, more and more people would be able to obtain 1 to 2 centimeter accuracy in the future. And so it's just going to exacerbate this problem of people keeping track of these epic dates and crustal movement and that sort of thing. And it's just not something that I don't think people are tuned into right now.
Yeah, one of the questions that raises is, in the surveying community, but we'll make the wild assumption that the surveying community grasps this issue and will take it into account as positions are reestablished. What do you think the impact is on the next tier of users of the data, the people who take the information and put it into GIS systems or whatever other systems they may have and may or may not update it? I don't know how often it's updated, but what's your thoughts on that in terms of the data that's published or made available through these other user sources?
Well, I think that the problem is this, essentially, is that surveyors, and I think we had this discussion out at the ESRI conference when I think Dave Doyle said something to this effect, and I agreed with him, or may have been someone else, but I remember Dave talking about this, was that surveyors are project-oriented people. They get involved in a project for, you know, a period of time. You know, it could be a week, could be a couple weeks. I think rarely is it probably years long. And when they're done with their project, they submit their data, their drawings, and they're done. And a lot of times this data is incorporated into other systems that are managed by GIS managers. And so surveyors end up being folks that create these data sets from a project. They push it into another system, and it maybe eventually ends up in a GIS somewhere. And so the GIS person is actually one that manages the data over the long term and really has to think about this crustal movement and other issues related to data management. I mean, that's sort of my take. What do you think, Michael?
Well, yeah, I agree with that. I think there's a profound shift occurring, and it's making – and I'm a registered land surveyor, by the way, so I'm – sympathetic to this, but it's making things pretty uncomfortable for surveyors. Positioning's become, it's being provided as a service that where you don't need any particular kinds of skills necessarily to operate the equipment anyway. And you already said before, Eric, that equipment's becoming much more precise. And the question is, well, how accurate is it? Because you can be very precise but still be a few feet off, say, for example. That's becoming extremely difficult. You said something earlier on, too, that makes it even more difficult. You said you like to always look at the date of data collection, say. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's the date of the coordinates. I think that's where it can become extremely confusing for people. I'm going to, because it's on my mind, I'll just go ahead and say it. Like, a common example I run into are RTNs. People use an RTN, which is very convenient. That's a real modern approach to positioning. Don't need to have a base. Many of those RTNs stream base coordinates, referenced as the most recent realization of NAT83, which is 2011, at EPIC 2010. But their unit, since it's quote-unquote GPS or GNSS, thinks it's actually WGS84, and then the software, the metadata gets recorded that way, and the software itself may, and this does happen, by the way, perform a transformation that's not necessary, right? And so that just adds to all this confusion. So some of the things that are confusing is the date of collection does not necessarily equal the epoch of the coordinates, and your metadata may be wrong, which is making things extremely difficult, especially now that equipment's out there that you don't have to be a land surveyor to use that's getting accurate down to the decimeter level easily, you know, fractions of a foot.
Yeah, I think actually a good example is if someone comes to you and says, hey, here's this data set, and it's referenced to ITRF 08, for example, and we can get into the description of what ITRF is, but that's sort of the datum of the future. But if someone says to you, this data is in ITRF 08, and so it really depends on what date that reference to depends on what really the source of that data was, because, for example, here's what I'm getting to, is that OmniStar and Starfire, which is John Deere's version of OmniStar, they broadcast in ITRF 08 epic date, the current date, so they continually upgrade the epic date of the reference network, whereas you might find, I think, a common epic date for ITRF 08 data, if I'm not mistaken, Michael, is 2005.0, right?
Yeah, that's how they're published, and that's the sort of the reference time.
Yeah, so that's sort of the one you would expect would be 2005.0, right? And so if you don't know if someone's doing something different, I mean, that's what 2005 to now is, what, 8 years of crustal movement. And like I said, if you're in California, it's 5 centimeters a year. If you're in Oregon, it's a few centimeters a year, and it can be really significant.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah.
And confusing.
I think that's the key, is how confusing it is more than anything.
So, Michael, maybe you can give us just a briefing on ITRF. So people probably are hearing more and more about the ITRF datum, and maybe you can have just a little bit of discussion about that.
Okay, I'll try and try not to make it too involved. Sort of the simplest way I think of it, anyway, is it's a global reference frame, and it's been in place. It's called the International Terrestrial Reference System, ITRS, and I guess you could think of it as realizations of it, or implementations of it, are called ITRF, International Terrestrial Reference Frame. And we've had many of those over the years, the latest being called ITRF 2008, with an epic date of 2005.0, but continuously they have velocities associated with them. That's why we're able to get coordinates that are at different dates. The key to it all is it's global. And the reason it's global is because of satellites. Another global one that people hear about all the time, and I always get uneasy when I say it, but it's WGS-84. Lately, the military, NGA, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, has done a good job of aligning WGS-84 with ITRF, so they are the same. You can consider them the same at the noise level of the observations. This last one, they're by construction, they're the same. So that is good, but it's still confusing. So you've got WGS-84, the current realization, and ITRF 2008, and there's also one called IGS-08, which is the GNSS-only version of ITRF. Just to make that clear, let me say it again because I know it's confusing. IGS and ITRF and WGS-84 are all constructed the same. There is no transformation between them. It's zero. But IGS is only based only on GNSS data, whereas ITRF is based on GNSS data plus other methods. So it's considered more robust. And WGS-84 is also GPS specifically only, but it utilizes ITRF to make it more robust also. I feel like I slaughtered that. Did that help at all?
Maybe it's a good time to take a break,
yeah.
Michael. We're almost right at the time for the next break, so maybe during the break you and Eric can talk about unslaughtering it.
That sounds good.
We need to do that. But I think our audience understands that it's a very, all this is very highly technical, and everything is acronym soup these days. So
yeah.
I know it's hard for people to grasp, but let's go ahead and take our next break, and we'll pick up on that when we come back.
Hi, Bob Eberson back with some big news from Seanstead. We've added a grand prize to our 60th anniversary Great Locator giveaway program, a Caribbean cruise for two, plus travel allowance and spending money. You're automatically entered for the year-end drawing when you enter to win a Seanstead magnetic locator, which you can do every 60 days. Visit Seanstead.com for complete details and your chance to win.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Hi, Bob Eberson for Seanstead Instrument Company. We're celebrating our 60th year in business by giving away a Seanstead magnetic locator every 60 days throughout 2013. Along with that, we'll be giving gift certificates in the amount of $60 each and good for any Seanstead product or service to 60 entrants during each 60-day period. So be sure to enter up to 6 times throughout the year at www.shonstead.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back for our third segment with Michael Dennis and Eric Axtetter today. And before we went to break, we were talking about, Michael was giving us an explanation, and it was interesting during the break, a series of articles that Eric has written for Geospatial Solutions is called Nightmare on GIS Street, Accuracy Datums and Geospatial Data, and the two of them concluded that perhaps where we were headed with the conversation was the nightmare or the beginning of it. So maybe we can have a further discussion about that. Before we get into that, though, for the sake of our audience, let's spend a few seconds debating when the two of you became acquainted so people can send in their answer to that question.
Michael, you want to take a first stab? I have a pretty good idea, I think.
Okay, you probably better than me.
Go ahead.
What I remember, and this is what you can come in and correct me afterward, this memory I have is meeting you in person and having a meal together in Anchorage, Alaska, and I think it was 2006.
Yeah, that's the same memory I have, but I think it was 2008 or 2009.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember when I was up there. I think it was 2008, actually.
It might have been. That might not have been my first time then. My first time was 2006.
Well, then, yeah, for the sake of the audience, we're going to compromise on 2008.
Yeah, okay. So the Alaska Survey and a Mapping Conference in Anchorage in 2008. Fantastic conference, by the way. They really do a good job putting that one together.
They do. Yeah, I really enjoy going to that one, and they always have it at such a nice time of the year when it's nice and warm.
Yeah,
at least there's no mosquito.
I was a few years ago, I was in Fairbanks. It was 22 below zero, and I was out walking through the ice sculpture competitions.
But I tell you, all the people I've talked, I've been to Alaska probably 5 times now, and I've always gone the winter time. And people tell me that's a smart time of year to go there because the bugs won't carry you away.
That is true. I was there during summer solstice a few times, and it is different. There's no question about that. So, getting us back on topic here a little bit, Michael was going to. Or maybe the two of you are going to take a stab at maybe simplifying what we were talking about before we went to break.
Well, since I...
Yeah, I just really, really quickly to summarize, I guess, sorry, is, you know, so Michael mentioned IGS 08, ITRF 08, and WGS 84. Even though they all have different names, for all intents and purposes, when you think of one, they're interchangeable. There's no transformation between the three. Is that correct, Michael?
That's correct, especially nowadays.
Yeah, and that was, you know, WGS 84, and I just wrote an article late last week on GPS World, my survey scene newsletter, that sort of digs into the history of WGS 84 in general, because it's kind of a, what do you call it? It's kind of a black hole in terms of, there really isn't any reference on the ground that you can say, oh, here's a WGS 84 location that I want to test my receiver against. You just have to assume that it's the same as ITRF 08 or IGS 08 to do that comparison, right?
Yeah. There's no marks to occupy that have a published WGS 84 coordinates.
Yeah, so in fact, in this article I wrote last week, I sort of argue, and Michael has debated a little bit, I've argued that we shouldn't even have WGS 84 in our conversation as geospatial folks, because you might as well use ITRF 08, because that's the one of the future, I think, that folks are going to migrate towards. And Michael has some different opinions, and so I'd like to hear those, I think, from the audience.
I don't know that they're really different. It's the statement in the article is, you know, the WGS 84 should not be in your geospatial vocabulary. Of course, it's kind of impossible to do that nowadays, because WGS 84 is everywhere. I mean, it's the reference frame or datum people put in their metadata for all sorts of things. So I don't think we can get away from it. My argument was more people need to understand what it really means. And if you're going to say you're referenced to something, then you ought to be referenced. You ought to choose a thing you really are referenced to. And that would go to what you were saying a minute ago, that it would be, say, ITRF, if that's really what you're using. For example, the OmniStar HP or something like that, which really is. It gets a little sticky, though, some of this stuff.
I just kind of think of it as something that, I don't know, it seems to me like extra baggage that doesn't need to be out there. I mean, when someone says, and maybe it's because people don't use a designator with it, like with the ITRF, they'll use,
right,
you know, ITRF-00 or ITRF-96 or ITRF-2008, and then people right. never seem to use any kind of designator with WGS-84, and it's kind of like, to me, it's kind of like NAT-83. If you say NAT-83, you know, I sit there and I put my arms up and I say, well, which one? Because, you know, the first one that came out is very, very different than the current realization. And you can say the same thing about WGS-84.
Yeah, that's very true. And even worse, WGS-84, the datum has the same name as the ellipsoid, so it makes it even more confusing. WGS-84 is kind of a problem. I think, though, I have a hard time imagining going away. It's so pervasive. And the thing I had stated in our correspondence about it is the idea that perhaps NGA should do a better job of promulgating information about it. And you came back saying that you thought they were because they're, you know, one way they're doing it is aligning themselves with ITRF. I just don't think that is broadcast very much to people, to the outside. Though I believe, well, actually, I more than believe, I know that NGA came to us and asked us to put WGS-84 on our Opus output.
Huh, interesting.
So that's a way to make it more transparent in the sense that people say, oh, WGS-84 is IGS-08 because it says so right on our Opus output. And I think we may do that. I don't know quite where we are with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did release, and it's interesting, just by way of background, NGA is the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, right?
Yes.
They serve the Department of the U.S. Department of Defense and the intelligence community. And so that's their audience. And so when they make a change, for example, last year they made a change, last February, so 16 months ago, they made a change. That's when they brought WGS-84 in alignment with ITRF-08.
That's right.
But there really wasn't much noise about that. It really wasn't, you know, there's probably a press release maybe, in fact, that don't even remember that, but they do have a document that describes it. But I think what you're saying, and I agree,
yeah,
is that there's just not much PR about this. There's not much promotion or, I guess, marketing, if that's the right word,
about this. And I was going to talk to them about it. I think I'm not sure what they're trying to do. I think a lot of people didn't even know about it until the ION conference, say, right?
Right, like 6 months later, right.
Right, exactly. So that catches people off guard. Now, the reality is, though, and this is where, you know, scientists can drive the practitioners crazy. Each of the last few iterations of WGS-84 and ITRF, the location and the coordinates only changed at the millimeter level, or at the most a centimeter, but probably less than that, less than sub-centimeter. Sub-centimeter. It's important to keep some of that in mind and keep it in perspective. What causes coordinates to change in larger magnitudes, the kind of magnitudes we've been talking about in the show, you know, multi-centimeter, decimeter even, are those velocities.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key. So the scientists know where the geocenter is extremely accurately now, so that part's not really changing. We keep refining things and getting better velocities, but it's pretty well nailed down, really.
Mm-hmm. And I should say that WGS-84, the original version of it, I mean, it's far different than what it is today by the order of, what, a meter or a meter and a half or something like that. But it did come into alignment with ITRF fairly early on. If I would go back and read my own article, I could tell you precisely.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now on the computer here. So I have trouble remembering all this stuff.
I think it was late 90s maybe, or mid 90s, somewhere on there, where WGS-84 was brought into alignment within probably centimeters, right? Centimeter level. And I don't remember exactly what was in there, but it was really close. And so from mid to late 90s until now, it's been in agreement with ITRF and just been refined over the years each iteration.
And I think they've gotten, in this very last one, they truly aligned it, I mean, by construction. And the one prior to that was so close it didn't matter anyway. So now I think they're being a lot more proactive about making sure they are really essentially one and the same.
So, Michael, I don't know if you can answer this. I'll just sort of throw it out there. But so ITRF, who is it actually run by, or who is it, who manages ITRF? And I think it's some folks out of France, a research organization. But so is that, what was the reasoning behind them being sort of the lead on this? Do you have any idea of the history on that?
I don't know a lot about it, but it's the International Earth Rotation Services, and it is out of France. Though it's a global community, it's part of, I should be more involved in this and I'm not, but it's part of the International Association of Geodesy. So, and this is something that's been worked on globally for quite a few years. There's agreed upon techniques, mathematical techniques and models that the entire global geodetic community uses as part of this. It's because of the nature of the problem of being international in scope. You know, you need to have stations all over the world.
It's
truly, truly international in character, and really a lot of agreement, a lot of standardization for the scientific community. I think the part that's become difficult is translating that to us, the feet-on-the-ground practitioners. That's the difficulty. And that might be a good segue, if we're ready for it, into how these modernizations or these changes are being implemented in software or not, as the case may be, versus software.
That's a good place to go. We have a couple minutes before the break, and we can extend it into the last part, because I wanted to have you talk about that, and then kind of at the end, you know, what's the takeaway for the users, and what how is this going to affect them? What do they need to do? And you know, if there's equipment issues, software issues, or processing issues, or whatever the case may be. So, according to my magic clock, I think we have about 2 minutes before the break. So, if you want to start on the software, then I may just have to take the break when it comes.
Well, I think really quickly, if you don't mind, let's talk about a little bit about the relationship between ITRF 08 and NAD 83 for our North American users. Maybe, Michael, if you can talk about that relationship in 90 seconds.
Well, we'll do that when we get cut off. We'll just come back to it. So right now, everybody's really, they're struggling with it. All the vendors know about it. They've known about it for years. I don't care who it is, Trimble, Topcon, Leica, it doesn't matter. Esri, they all know. But they're having a hard time dealing with the relationship between this global reference frame, which we call WGS84, ITRF, or IGS, that, and regional ones, in this case, North American Datum of 1983. There is no commercial software package out there right now, it appears, or they're just starting to make those changes, so it's up in the air. But nobody really is handling that transformation correctly, or very, very few are. So that's the problem. People have these data sets that are, let's say, nominally in WGS84, how do they get them into NAD83 correctly?
That may be a really good question for our audience to ponder while we go on break.
Okay.
Because that's a pretty interesting statement that I'm sure will be of great interest to our audience, and when we come back we can have you guys discuss that and, as I said, give some takeaway. So let's take that break quickly, and then we'll come back.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Hi, everybody. It's Don Zabkar, your host for Who Knew? We air Mondays 2 to 3 on America's Web Radio, and then occasionally throughout the week. We've got some great subjects. This administration, or this regime, as you know, is providing us with great material. So stay tuned. Check us out. America's Web Radio, it's Who Knew with Don Zabkar.
Hi, Bob Eberson back with some big news from Schoenstead. We've added a grand prize to our 60th anniversary Great Locator giveaway program, a Caribbean cruise for two plus travel allowance and spending money. You're automatically entered for the year-end drawing when you enter to win a Schoenstead magnetic locator, which you can do every 60 days. Visit Schoenstead.com for complete details and your chance to win.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for our final segment with Michael Dennis and Eric Dackstetter, and you guys both know I always talk about how quickly the hour goes. Well, it has really gone fast today. So we wanted to pick up on the conversation when we had broken away. Michael was talking about some of the software issues that everybody's facing, the people who create the software, the people who use the software, and it's an issue for everyone.
Yeah, it's just, back in my product development days back in the 90s, I mean, as a product developer back then, I had to make decisions about how to implement certain algorithms that we actually from NGS or DMA at the time, I think, Defense Mapping Agency. I kind of said to myself back then, this is a real example, and I was a guilty party back then. I said, hey, you know, what are the big competitors using? I'll use the same stuff because they must be doing it right. Maybe that's the hesitancy today is that the vendors, even the major ones, aren't quite sure what to do or how to handle it. And if I can frame the problem right, it's not really getting from ITRF 08 to NAT 83, because that's a pretty straightforward 14 parameter transformation if you do it correctly. But the other challenge, and I've written about this, and Michael has talked about this a bunch, is how do you align or how do you reconcile the epoch dates? You know, if you collect data in a certain, you know, say it's, for example, NAT 83 is defined, the latest one is defined as epoch date 2010. And let's say you're collecting data from Omnistar or some other source that's broadcasting in ITRF epoch date current, which is, you know, 3.5 years later than 2010. How do you take into account that crustal motion, or do you take into account that crustal motion, that 3.5 years of movement? And that's sort of the challenge. I don't know. Would you agree with that, Michael?
Oh, yeah. That's the change over time is the one that's causing the most trouble for the vendors because they hadn't had to think about it before. And again, they're aware, but I think they're afraid of how their users are going to respond to this. How do you build a software package that allows you to have the power and flexibility to do all these different things yet not make a confusing mess out of it?
And I was talking to at the ESRI conference, I was speaking to, and I'm not picking on the ESRI, I think it's a fantastic company. I was talking to one of the datum transformation programmers, and you can tell he wants to do something, and he understands the problem thoroughly. But he says, okay, how do I handle it when I've got a company with a pipeline or some road infrastructure or something that crosses a major fault plate in California, where all of a sudden stuff in one part of the California is moving 5 centimeters a year, and the other part's moving maybe a different direction. I don't know California that well, but maybe a different direction, 2 centimeters a year. He says, how do I deal with that in software? He said, that seems to be the major challenge.
Right. And as far as, NGS goes, we do have a piece of software that does all that. It's called horizontal time-dependent positioning, and all the vendors are very much aware of it.
Right.
There's been some reluctance, I think, to adopt it, again, because of the complexity. You know, the key on the positioning, the real key is making sure that all your epoch dates, we'll call them that, are the same, are consistent. As soon as you start mixing those up, you start having problems, especially in the parts of the places that you're talking about where you get in, like, southwestern California. In other places, mm-hmm. though, as well.
Right. Yeah, and I think, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, but I think surveyors have sort of been immune to this problem because if you go back to the comment I made at the beginning of the hour about surveyors being sort of project-oriented, they're data creators on a local basis for the most part, and they're passing that off to GIS managers who are managing and maintaining this data over the long term. I mean, they really have to be thinking about this. If you think about, okay, I want to go out and spend an inordinate amount of time and energy mapping, let's say, water valves for my water distribution system, and I want to do it down to the, let's say, 10 centimeter level, and I want to be able to revisit those water valves every year, and let's say if you start to push out to 10 years, again, if you've got even 2 or 3 centimeters of crustal plate movement, you have to take that into account if you want to be able to zero in within 10 centimeters, because 2 centimeters a year over 20 or over 10 years is 20 centimeters, and even worse in California and maybe Hawaii and some other locations. And so GIS managers end up becoming, and that's where in my consulting business, that's where I see the most issue these days, is those folks are trying to get a grip on this. And in many cases, they aren't even aware the problem exists until I mention it to them, or we try to line up data. I mean, that's kind of been the classic, is that they'll implement an RTK, and then they'll say, well, my stuff doesn't line up. And this is the same question I've gotten for 20 years, is why doesn't my data line up? And then you start having to dig into, okay, what are you comparing it to? And a lot of times folks are comparing it to aerial photography, orthophotography, and they think that just because they can see a picture on the screen, that is the most accurate data out there. And if the GPS isn't lining up to it, that means the GPS must be wrong, which isn't the case in most cases, because photogrammetry is actually, it can be pretty rough sometimes.
And it might be based off the GPS anyway. I mean, so...
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a real problem. I agree with... Data managers are being thrust in a situation that's totally unfamiliar to them, the kind that you're talking about. But it's a question of understanding. I mean, if your GIS data set is defined as Natity 2011, Epic 2010, you're locked down in time. I mean, you'll be okay, with the exception of areas where you get some real differential motion because there has been an earthquake. That should be, and Californians are good at dealing with that. But they have the same exact issue. They want to do common Epic dates. So if you do that, you reference it specifically to something, just keep doing that, and it'll remain consistent over time. So that part, again, it's one of understanding, but it's tough. So that's the GIS people. Now, if they use surveyors to collect the data, this is where surveyors are getting thrust into it too, somewhat unwillingly, I think. They have to be able to provide the data that's consistent as well. And because the software is getting more sophisticated and starting making decisions for you, it might perform a transformation that you don't want it to get you to some datum or some current time or something. I've seen this before. It'll take something that was already correct and move it 4 feet. Right? That's becoming more and more common. I think it's going to get worse. And before we end all this too, Kurt and Eric, like you said, we ought to give some kind of takeaway for people too about how to move forward, how to use the tools they have right now effectively and try to prevent these sorts of errors.
Yeah, we've got 5 minutes or maybe close to five and a half, so maybe in that amount of time we can provide that takeaway for the I won't say the everyday user, but the people who have to deal with it.
Yeah, so I guess the takeaway for me is that you have to, when someone passes you, first of all, when someone passes you a particular data set, you have to ask the question of where it came from and how it was generated. And my guess is that half the time or maybe more than that, the people who are giving you data aren't going to know.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to know the Epic data. If they send you an ortho photo, and I've had this. I've had this situation where people have sent it to me. I say, well, what is it reference to? Well, it's an Nat 83.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, that leads to another, more, okay, which iteration of Nat 83? And, of course, they get a bit confused there. And then if I want to put the nail in the coffin, I'll ask them what Epic date, you know, and that, of course, sends them to the pub.
Because
right. Then you have to start working yourself backwards. Okay, who'd you get it from? Let me talk to that person.
Right.
And then sometimes you'll end up getting back to the surveyor who set the control for the ortho photo. And, you know, maybe they know and maybe they don't know. Maybe they forgot. Maybe they didn't record it. And so a lot of times you don't know and you're not going to find out the source of the data or how it was referenced. And you just have to sort of say, okay, well, at least that's an unknown. I know it's an unknown, and I can't bank on that particular data myself. But what you can control is new data that you create, and you preserve that like it's the family jewels. I mean, and because I've heard of these horror stories of people who will collect this high precision. They'll spend thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars on this equipment capable of 2 centimeter, 1 centimeter accuracy. They'll go out and collect data, let's say on water valves or manhole covers or whatever. They'll bring it into the GIS. It doesn't line up with what's in the GIS. And so what do?
They move it.
They move the GPS data. And it sends me to the loony bin when they do that, because hey, it's the only piece of data that you know is good, or is at least you know, understand the history about it. And so it's the last thing you should. Okay, well maybe you can shift it to make it look good for the map, but at least preserve the fundamental geodesy, I guess, of that data. And then because you know, eventually, just a matter of time before you have to move your stuff that's wrong into the right. closer to being in the right location.
So the new answer is the old answer. Because historically, through the surveying profession, we've always had to keep really good information on what we did, where the information came from, how we made decisions, regardless, I mean, whether it was defining somebody's property boundary or providing other information. So it maybe we'll put a different context on preserving the records of how data was created and from what sources it came. But in a way, it is the same answer we've always had.
No, that's an excellent point. It is the same answer it's always been. We're supposed to leave footsteps, aren't we?
Yeah.
But what's happened in recent several to many years now, because everything has become so digital and high-tech and confusing and black box, people aren't leaving footsteps. They don't even know how to leave footsteps.
Yeah, I think that's part of the key is knowing how to leave footsteps.
Right, because most of the vendors will say your stuff's in WGS84 or whatever, and survey-grade stuff, and it really isn't. Yet that's the metadata you propagate on to your customers. I've seen this over and over again when it's not quite correct, or just NAT83 vanilla. So the takeaway for surveyors is when you provide data, when you provide services, first of all, make sure you and the client agree on exactly what it is you're going to provide in writing, and you provide the metadata of exactly what it is. Because I'll guarantee this, if you do, say, photo control for aerial mapping, what I see every time, so far anyway, is when I give the control to the aerial company as NAT83 2010, EPIC 2010.0, it comes back as NAT83 vanilla every single time. Even though they didn't do anything, they just called it that.
And well, I think we're right on a minute or so from the end. So that's a good thing to leave, is to keep good solid data and make sure you provide what you're going to do in writing. We can't ever give anybody more better advice than that.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you guys being with me today, and we probably haven't taken the time to cover this as extensively as we should have, and maybe we can do this again sometime soon if you're available. But as always, the hour does end. It's like time moves on. And you know, I was laughing last week. I had my 65th birthday last week, so my birthday present was signing up for Medicare. So, you know, we get all those things. But I really appreciate you guys being with me today. It's been a great show and a lot of good information. So hopefully it'll generate some questions for us.
Very good.
Thank you very much, Kurt, for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks to both of you for being with me today. Take care.
All right.